Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aero Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guests Mike Harrell and Corey Monarchy, having a conversation on their experiences as clinicians who have been on both sides of the table from a respiratory therapist's perspective.
So welcome. I want to thank you, Mike Harrell, for joining us today. We are on the Conversations of Aero Digestive Management podcast, and I'm going to be talking with Mike Harrell, respiratory therapist, who has a story to share that gives us a perspective on both sides of the table. We have been talking to clinicians who have also had the experience of being a patient because of something that happened in their life, and then got to return to their clinical practice. And Mike Harrell, respiratory therapist, is going to introduce himself and share a little about his story and how he was able to have that perspective on being on both sides of the table.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I am a respiratory therapist. I have my BS degree in respiratory therapy. I finished that in 1979. Since then, I have worked in critical care. I worked in an outpatient clinic in West Virginia for a couple of years. I have taught in respiratory therapy, managed a respiratory therapy department in Florida for 25 years, and worked for Passing Year full-time for 17 years. And I just recently retired from Passing Year at the end of last year. So it's just a little bit about my experience.
You have had a broad experience of different settings and different positions. So I think even that alone would be a nice perspective. But do you mind sharing, because you do have a unique perspective, a little bit different than a lot of people have experienced. Do you mind sharing a little bit about when you started, like how long were you a respiratory therapist? And then what happened to change the way you were going to practice respiratory therapy?
Okay, well, yes, I finished first an associate's degree in respiratory therapy. Then I went to work after that for about a year and a half for an outpatient clinic in West Virginia. I was registered at that point. I decided that it was time to go back and get my bachelor's degree because to me it seemed a good move professionally and something that the profession was going to be moving towards. So I decided to go ahead and get it while I was still young. I graduated, and again, I was teaching actually for the college at the same time and was working full-time in acute care. I worked then briefly for Washington Adventist Hospital for about a little less than a year after graduating with my BS degree, and then moved down to Florida. At that point, I would say I had been working really professionally for about 7 years altogether. 6 weeks after moving to Florida to take a job as a respiratory therapist in a hospital in Punta Gorda, Florida, something did change that had a significant impact on the rest of my career and my life. Well, I loved to ride my bicycle back and forth from work. I really enjoyed my bike. So it was just a regular bicycle. And remember, this is 1980, and we didn't think about helmets, okay? We didn't think about those sorts of things. I just jumped on my bike, drove into work on my bike, changed clothes, did my shift. And then on May 11th in 1980, I was riding home from work between the hospital where I worked in Punta Gorda and where I lived in Port Charlotte. There is the Peace River, which is about a mile wide, and a big bridge goes over the river. And it was always fun to climb up that bridge, but then to go down the steep side and to gain speed. On the Port Charlotte north side, I was coming up to the very first intersection, which was a yield intersection. And that's the last thing I really remember. The next thing I remember was somebody trying to get something through to me. They were waking me up, trying to explain something to me that didn't make any sense. I knew only that I hurt from my head to my toes and that I couldn't see a thing. Over the next few weeks, as I gained consciousness and more alertness and awareness, I learned that I had been coming into that intersection with the yield sign, and a car struck the front of my bike, and it flew up over the handlebars, hit the windshield with the left side of my head, and shattered the windshield. He pulled out into the street, and when he stopped, I crumpled up on the pavement. I was taken into the hospital, did it all kinds of procedures and the like. The real result of that accident was 13 weeks in the hospital, and because of the accident and the head injury, it destroyed the vision in my eyes so that I was now blind. And that's what I woke up to afterwards.
You know, waking up or becoming conscious of everything around you, you know, coming out from all the medications and different things, do you remember that early first thoughts of the loss of your vision? And I mean, do you remember kind of what crossed your mind or how you were processing that information?
I do remember waking up, and it was really a gradual process. And my memory has just little snippets here and there of things that gradually started to become more of a picture. So it was a slow comprehension in my brain as to what has actually happened. I knew that, you know, I hurt mostly. But as I started to realize that I could not see and started to piece that together, my first recollections of any real thoughts on it were, what am I going to do as a blind respiratory therapist? I have a new little 13-month-old daughter and a wife. We just moved to Florida. What on earth am I going to do now?
I think that leads us, Mike, and this piece of your story has shocked me every time I think about it, but how much time was there between when you finally, you know, recovered enough to come out of the hospital and all, and when you actually returned to work and started functioning again as a respiratory therapist?
I was in the hospital 13 weeks. I was discharged and sent home and was out of work totally, including the hospital, for 6 months.
The reason I say that shocks me is I would have thought you'd be out with the adjustments, and we'll talk about those in just a moment, but the adjustments to the loss of vision and now being a blind respiratory therapist, I would have, if you had asked me, how long would it take? I would have thought it would take a couple of years, you know, or something to adjust and train. And you, including hospitalization, were back in 6 months. So do you mind sharing what some of the changes were and the adjustments were that you had to make? You know, how did you return to work in 6 months?
That was a real process. Again, this was 1980. Now we have all kind of discharge planning. You would have been sent out of the hospital with all kinds of potential resources and the like. I was not. I was sent out of the hospital with no resources, no references to anything in any way. I was just sent out of the hospital, mostly with the hospital expecting to be paid something. So that was not a pleasant discharge from the hospital. And I still remember discharge day thinking, you know, I should really be excited about this and happy about going home. But I wasn't. I was just scared to death. That's the primary feeling that I remember. I didn't know, how was I going to conduct my life at home, let alone get a job and get back to work and do something productive and support my family and all that I was supposed to do? Fortunately, and maybe I would have to confess, I view it as a real blessing, the person who was the supervisor of the respiratory department told me that he wanted me back to work, that he thought with my BS degree and with my skills and background, I had too much to offer just to let that sit. So he encouraged me, and I started trying to hunt down what kind of resources there might be that could help me do something productive for the department. There was a lot of research and things that went on, but I contacted and actually talked to someone on the phone, and I don't even remember who it was, but they said, have you tried the Florida Division of Blind Services? And I said, well, no, I didn't even know there was such a thing. So I called, and that was like opening this door with the light shining. I talked with them. they sent someone to my home, did an assessment, and we started working on accommodations and different tools that could be used to help me get back to work. And in the beginning, I had a little bit of vision left still in my right eye. So we got a big closed circuit TV magnification system so that I could actually read things. It took a while, but I could read them and I could write and I could do those sorts of things. And I started then doing continuing education for the department. And then pulmonary functions is an interesting thing because they were not completely just computer driven back then. We had the typical big machine with the big water seal bells that went up and down and all of that, but there was a computer attached to it. And that computer is what you used to drive all the mechanisms in the pulmonary function device. I talked with the fellow who wrote the software that drove all of that pulmonary function control stuff. Together with him, they developed for me specifically a program that would actually work through a speaker, and I could type in and the computer would verbally tell me everything that the computer was doing and everything that the pulmonary function machine was doing. It would tell me the baselines of their breathing, whether it was changing. It would give me values and volumes and all the things that I needed to do the pulmonary function testing. So my job for a couple of years was to be continuing education coordinator and to do all the pulmonary functions for the hospital. That's the way it stayed for some time, and I was just very appreciative to be back to work.
I still think that's amazing that within 6 months of your injury, you were able to return to work and return to the practice of respiratory therapy. So it wasn't even like you had to return to something in a new area or a new field. You were able to still work with respiratory therapy because you were doing the pulmonary function studies. But I know you got that computer program. What other adjustments did you have to make at work?
At first, I was able to do just a little bit of patient care. I could go see patients and do some evaluations and assessments and could do some of the treatments that didn't require a lot of close visual inspections. But as my vision became worse, that had to go away. And that was a hard thing for me because I enjoyed patient care. I enjoyed working with the patients and being able to help them. That was really something meaningful to me. What then happened that changed the picture was that the person who had been the director that I'd worked with left that position, and it left the position open. So the hospital had to decide what they would do about replacing the manager of the department. They chose, and I really credit them for this, because I'm sure from their perspective, it was quite a risk. They chose to put me in as acting director. I was shocked by their being willing to do that. But in doing that, I had to learn how to access more and more capabilities so that I could actually fulfill that position. Now, it moved me out of patient care, of course. And at first I continued to do the pulmonary functions, but one of the primary changes that has continued to be the mainstay of giving me a lot of flexibility in what I do was the voice or screen access, speech access to the screen. There are several programs that do that. The program that I was introduced to and have continued to use is JAWS, which is JAWS access for Windows with speech. And it takes what comes up on the computer and turns it into speech. It has all kinds of flexibility in the ways that I can read it. I don't have to just read the whole screen. I can tab through things. So I have complete access to the computer. As my function as the manager got larger, I found someone else to do the pulmonary function testing, and I continued to use the computer to do the work that I had to do, write policies and procedures. I could read memos. I could scan them in, and then the computer would read the scanned in memos. People could send emails to me. I went to meetings. I went to all the continuing education. So I could really do all of the functions that a department manager would need to do because of the technology that I had, that became just more and more useful and accessible and became better and better as time went on. Over the years, I became president of the Florida Society for Respiratory Care, and I did that twice around. I did speaking at different state conferences. So it's kind of just a little bit of the trajectory of how my profession developed to that point.
So Mike, with we're kind of doing with this particular podcast, you have that idea of kind of both sides of the table.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything that you experienced as a patient that you feel would be important for professionals to know or to learn from? Any kind, you know, is there anything, takeaways that you had that you'd like to share?
Yes, I have some experiences and some thoughts. I think that the general statement I would make is that remember that the patients you are taking care of are real people. They have real professions, real experience, real backgrounds, real emotional things going on, and they deserve your respect. You need to know a little bit about them and respect them and understand that there's a lot going on inside of their heads when you come into that room. And what's going on inside of their heads can seriously impact how they respond to you and what goes on. So I think that idea of respecting your patients and treating them as real people with real needs is really important. And I often thought that everybody who works in healthcare ought to try being on the other side of the sheets as well. I remember when I first started becoming more alert and aware of what was going on, I had a splint around my left arm because it had broken, and I had a nasal cannula in my nose. So I am this respiratory therapist with a BS degree who proceeds to unwrap all the splint around my arm and neatly set all the stuff on my chest and pull a nasal cannula out of my nose and put it on my chest because it stunk and I didn't like it. And I know that there were a couple of different responses to that. Some of the folks would come in and yell at me and tell me, why did I do that? Some would come in and understand that this poor fellow is not all together. So they just kind of, if you're taking it down again, remember this is what it's for. And I mean, I'm a BS degree RRT, I ought to know this. But those who respected me, I still remember, even though it was fuzzy at the time. Another key thing that I remember, and you have to remember that I'm laying on my back in my bed in traction and I can't see. I remember somebody who came in. I don't think she ever announced herself or told me who she was. I discovered and figured out that she wanted to draw some blood from me when she put that tourniquet around my arm and started poking around with her fingers to see if she could find a vein. And I was with it enough to finally figure that out, but not with it enough to kind of say, hey, who are you? But I remember her doing that, prodded around for a little while on the left arm, didn't say anything, then moved over to the right arm, put the tourniquet on that arm, prodded around for a little while, said, oh crap, and that's a polite version of what she said, poked around there for a little more, took the tourniquet off and left the room. She never told me anything. She didn't tell me anything about what she was doing, why she was there, did she ever get the blood? I don't know, never knew. Whether she ever got the blood or not, didn't know what was going on.
Mike, I think you're bringing up two really good points, and they actually kind of link together. It's almost under the umbrella of one as far as respecting the patient, and that shows up in a lot of different ways. That's a really good illustration of an example where we also need to speak to our patients, communicate with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, share what we're doing, introduce ourselves. We sometimes forget, we get in a hurry, we run in and do something. And sometimes people make assumptions about patients that they can't hear or see or understand, or they're asleep, or you know, they just kind of assume that there's something going on with the patient that would make them unable to participate. And that's not necessarily true.
Right, and that is true. It was very disturbing to me. I would say, no matter how busy you are, no matter what's going on, remember that these are real people, and that's important.
No, I think it is too, and I think that I know, I mean, we don't have, today is a shortened version, a much, much shortened version of your whole story. I will share that your whole story is available in the Top Gear newsletter that was published at the end of 2021. It shares your whole story. But in this podcast, we're focused on that idea of, you know, both sides of the table and what you learn as a clinician, as a respiratory therapist who was practicing and then unfortunately experienced a pretty severe accident, which led to a complete change in how you function and your continued work practices. You had to adapt new strategies and new programs. And is there one takeaway that you would, from your story, that you would want to share with people?
The most important lesson that I learned was not to let others determine what your limitations are. Because had I listened to others, I would never have gone back to work as a respiratory therapist. It's something you have to sometimes even aggressively push against, because people see the limitations and not the capabilities. And I think that was a big lesson.
Oh, I think that's a fabulous point to end on. I think that is well stated and something that everyone can take away, not to put limitations on anyone. I think that that's a good point for people to take away and put into practice. During this time, you were able to hear Mike share about his time, both as a patient and as a respiratory therapist, and the impact that his experiences as a patient and the changes to his life brought to his career as a respiratory therapist. Now we're going to transition over and hear the experiences that Corey had as a respiratory therapist who also was in an accident that led to his experiences with the tracheostomy and using a speaking valve. So now let's listen to Corey's story.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
This is Kristen King sitting in the exhibit hall at ASHA speaking with Corey Monarchy. Corey is a respiratory therapist here to chat with us today.
Yes.
What are we going to chat about, Corey?
Yeah, let's chat about the passive mitral valve.
All right, we will start there. What brought you to have an interest in the passive mitral valve?
I was a practicing respiratory therapist, and one day I woke up in my ICU and I had a trach one day. And I thought, as a clinician, I knew everything about a trach, and it turns out I didn't know anything about a trach. And what I experienced having a trach and the complications and the frustrations as a patient, not being able to communicate, not being able to talk to any of my family members and my doctors for that matter, nurses, etc., became a big frustration. And I can remember times where I couldn't do things, and 2 weeks before then I could do things. And it turns out it was because I didn't have a valve on my trach. Pictures of me before I had my passive mitral valve on, and I have pictures of me having my passive mitral valve on. I want max assist to standby assist with my ADLs of walking in the hospital, and I have pictures to verify that that changed my life.
Who introduced you to the passive mitral
valve? It was one of our trauma surgeons at my hospital, and I progressively got off the ventilator, and once I got the ventilator off, I couldn't do anything. I was total max assist. And once I got my trach downsized, one time it was get out of my way, I'm getting better. And it totally changed everything.
So did they use the valve with you after you came off the ventilator?
Yes.
Not while you were on the ventilator?
Not yeah. Mm-hmm. At that time I was on a ventilator for ventilation. I wasn't ventilating well because I had aspirated. And they had bronched me 4 times because I had so much food in my lungs.
Oh, wow.
And I collapsed. I had bilateral pneumothoraxes. And I had flail chest as well. So I had 5 chest tubes. And it just was not ideal for me to get to that point yet.
But now you said food in your lungs. Had you not had a swallowing evaluation?
Well, I aspirated in my car crash.
Oh,
at the scene.
At the scene. Okay.
Yeah. So once they bronched me, they went and I had brain surgery, and then I ripped off, almost my whole left ear was ripped off.
Oh, wow.
So that all got replaced like the next day.
Okay.
So I had to put all my chest tubes in. But I had to go on a special ventilator, which we never use, because I was not ventilating at all.
Yeah.
So, and I don't remember any of that, of course.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I have pictures of me, you know, with my platform walker, people walking me, and I was slumped over the front of this thing. with one picture with an open trach, and then I feel like a week later I have another picture where it was a standby assist and I didn't have anybody helping me at all. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was the pacemaker valve that changed it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the pacemaker valve made a change in it?
I think the big thing is I could communicate, so my motivation mm-hmm. had changed a lot. I think the most important thing as I look back over that is I could put intrathoracic pressure inside of my lungs and I could pressurize my lungs to allow me to do things. Mm-hmm. And that was what changed everything. And I didn't know it then. Yeah. But knowing what I know now as an RT and dealing with patients that are struggling with stuff, I can see this clinically.
Yeah.
And you can see it change. If people could start doing things on their own, turns out they are more motivated to do things.
So how long did it take you to recover and get home and everything after your accident?
Yeah, so I went to Madonna Rehabilitation Center in Lincoln. And
that's one of our centers of excellence.
It was, yeah. I worked there as an RT. For a long time, 12 years. This is my PRN job. So I saw it clinically in rehab and I saw it acutely in the hospital that I worked at. So I went to Madonna for a little while, got my trach pulled there. I had to go some PT, OT. I had to do a lot of things. I worked with speech a little bit. And then when I came back to work, I could only do 4-hour shifts. I lost so much weight. I couldn't even walk upstairs anymore. And I was in the military, so I was doing PT all the time. I was running and doing I couldn't do any of that stuff because I degenerated so much. My atrophy was just terrible. But so when I came back to work, I was doing 4-hour shifts. And I went back through all my competencies just per my request. It's like, hey, I passed all the exams and tests, right? But I need to go through this again. So I went back through all my competencies again. So I think it took about a month and a half before I went back to full time. Mm-hmm. So because I was on short-term disability and things like that. And I feel like a lot of it, just because of the hospital that I worked at, you knew everybody. So it was more people were touching my shoulder like, dude, I can't believe that you lived through this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, after having a trach and using the valve and all, did that change your perspective on how you work with your patients
Everything.
In the hospital?
Yeah. Empathy. My empathy has changed a lot with that because now they need someone to fight for them. And you just need, it's lack of education most of the time. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is, it's just education. So people want to run away from things they're not familiar with. And in healthcare, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
So you were saying Mike
Yeah,
you.
So I was the vice president of our state board in Nebraska. And Mike called me on one random day asking if I needed someone to speak at our state conference. And I was like, yes, come. Please, I need speakers. So he had came to Nebraska and spoke at our state conference, and he and I conversed for quite a while about some things, and I had shared with him that I had the trach and I was a respiratory therapist, etc. And then I feel like it was like a year later, he called me on the telephone and asked me if I was interested in joining the team. So, and that's where my journey started, was joining the pacemaker team, and now I'm out educating.
Yes, so, you are.
I love it.
With COVID and all that's been going on in your hospital and what you've heard, what has changed in how you can work with your patients with tracheostomy or use of the valve? You know, how soon you can get in with them, that type, you know, what are the changes you've seen?
Yeah, and I feel like the policies are changing all the time on that. What we thought we knew 2 months ago is a little bit different than what we know today. So I think it's a case-by-case thing. Depending on the lung compliance of patients, depending on O2 needs, et cetera. And staffing is a big, big issue as well. We're understaffed and we have more ventilators per respiratory therapist. And it's concerning sometimes. So recently I put a valve on a patient who was going hospice, end of life. I helped the guy let him talk to his family. I was a big advocate for him. And he just wanted to go home and expire. And he didn't want any of the stuff we were doing. So we put a valve on and we had all this family there that we could allow. Mm-hmm. And we had we were FaceTiming with family members to allow him to talk to these people so that way he could get home to be with his family so we could expire. Which was, you know, it's tear-jerking, totally. But to allow the family to have those closures with him, to be able to communicate, mm-hmm. Dad, are you sure this is what you want? Yep, this is exactly what I want. I don't want any of this stuff. He was a farmer from a small area, so, you know, he doesn't want anything. He just wants to go home. So that's what he wanted. So it was good to listen to them, have those communications.
Yes.
And when the personal stuff was starting, you know, we the nurse and I just went out and stood out in the hallway to let them have that talk. So that way I could address the ventilator and help them. So it was good. It was a good experience.
So you've definitely had the perspective as a patient and then as a respiratory therapist. Is there anything you would say to either inspire or to educate other RTs and SLPs about what they need to know to kind of close that gap?
Yeah. So my approach to that is, if this was your loved one, what would you want? And when you take it with that approach, you'll spend the time, you'll do the stuff that you need to do to allow those patients to do that. If you put yourself in their shoes, it changes perspectives on everything. So, because if that was your daughter, your husband, or your wife, or your parent laying there, you would want that, right? So if you have that approach on everything, it's amazing what you can make time for.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.